Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, Father.
And you're very welcome. So we're going to spend this retreat with the help of St. Mark and his Gospel, composed no more than 30 years after the death of Jesus. Of course, Paul's letters predated, and about the same time, in the middle 60s, maybe that's when we have the letter of James and the first letter of Peter, the letter to the Hebrews. So it was a rich time of writing, but his is the first of the Gospels, most probably. And of course, his focus is on Jesus, so which of course the retreat is our focus too. So we're going to be having a very privileged journey, keeping our eyes on Jesus. To help you with this, and not to distract you, I have a website which you can see there, MB, it's my Christian name, and Michael Byron, mbfallon.com. And if you clicked on that, a page would open, similar to what you see there. Then you go to the left menu and click on New Testament. Then the New Testament page will open up, and you go down to Mark. It's very obvious. Click on Mark, and then the Mark page opens. Then you have to scroll down a while till you get to this retreat. But it's all there waiting for you, not so that you look at it during the retreat. You've already got that happening here. And the last thing we want you to do, I think Michelle made a pretty strong recommendation that we give the Holy Spirit a go and not rely too much on media. So this is so that when you go home, you know that any of the pictures, any of the poems, any of the statements, any of the readings, anything that's up there during this 8 days is on my website. And you can get it when you go home if you want to look at it again. I also have, which may also help you, I did write a commentary on Mark's Gospel 20 years ago, actually. And back there near the piano, there is those books that Michelle spoke about that I've written. And then there's a pile of Mark's books there. You're welcome. I had to buy them for $25. So since I'm determined to make a profit, I want you to pay $25 if you have one. So there, then, there's a little box you can stick the $25 in and take a copy. So let's begin now. It's an introduction tonight. As of tomorrow, of course, we'll be getting straight into the text. And what I'm hoping you'll do, because it's your retreat, is by all means bring an exercise book along or something, but not to write down what I'm saying, because that's available all over the place. But to write down any responses you may have. Heart responses, prayer responses, because that's what you'll take into prayer. That's what the risen Christ is wanting you to hear. So you can hear my voice, of course, but what you're listening for is the boom, the inner echo of your response to it. So let's begin the introduction. Who is Mark? Well, in the Acts of the Apostles, written by Luke, a little bit later, we read, Peter went to the house of Mary, the mother of a young man called John, whose other name was Mark, where many had gathered and were praying. This is in Jerusalem. Now, Mark, it's quite common, by the way, for people, men and women in those days to have a Hebrew name and a Greek name, or Greek-Roman name. For example, you've heard a few Marks. Marcus Aurelius, one of the emperors. Mark Antony's pretty well known with Cleopatra and all the rest of it. So Marcus is a common enough Roman Greek name. John, Yohanan, means Hanan is grace, and Yoh is short for Yahweh, so God's graciousness is a Hebrew name. So this John is called Mark and may well be the author of our gospel. Can't give you certainty on that, but it's highly likely. In which case, since Peter knows his mother and Mark is there in the home, he knew Peter very early on. It's not impossible that he may have watched some of the story of Jesus when he was in Jerusalem, but we don't know. Another text, again from the Acts, talks about Barnabas and Saul returned to Jerusalem. This was after a meeting in returned to Jerusalem and brought with them John, whose other name was Mark. A little bit more information. That's a map of, you can see what it is. And in, again, the Acts of the Apostles, we read missionary, it talks about the missionary journey to southern Galatia. Galatia was a Roman province which included the tribal Galatian area, but also came round here as well. That's Cilicia, where Paul was brought up. And their early journey went to Perga, Lystra, Antioch, Iconium, Derbe, and then back again to Antioch. So that was Paul's first journey. And they took with them John, Mark. But he pulled out. He got as far as they went here to Cyprus, which was Barnabas's hometown. Then they went up here to the river port of Perga. And by that time, John Mark, we don't know why, but he was too tough. So he left it to his uncle, cousin, Barnabas, and Paul to continue on their own. Again, second journey, Barnabas was keen to take John, also called Mark, same one. But Paul said, look, I got too much to do, I'm too busy, he's got to go home and grow up. So Mark left and fades out of that missionary journey, and Paul took with him another person, Silas. So there's a little bit of information about this John Mark, who's likely our author. Paul, in his letter to the Colossians, written probably from Ephesus, writes Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, concerning whom you've received instructions, greets you. If he comes to you, welcome him. And he also talks about Luke, the beloved physician, greets you. So here we have, in the middle 50s, 10 years before Mark's gospel, in probably Ephesus, Paul's there, and with him is Mark and Luke. A very early connection between the two, because later there'll be a big connection. Luke will say to Mark, look, thanks for your gospel, and he'll add in a whole lot of stuff he was interested in as a historian and so on. So there's these two together in Colossae, or in Ephesus. At the same time, Paul wrote a personal letter to a man called Philemon. And in verses 23 to 4, he says, Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, sends greeting to you, as do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke. So there they are together again, my fellow workers. So whatever happened between Paul and John Mark at Perga, and whatever made Paul uncomfortable in having him with him on his second journey, clearly they've made up. In his letter to Timothy, written early 60s, he writes, Paul writes, only Luke is with me. Get Mark. Bring him with you. He's useful in my ministry. And in the first letter of Peter now, chapter 5, verse 13, he concludes his letter with this statement, your sister church in Babylon, Rome, sends you greeting, as does my son Mark, my son, pupil, younger man who Peter's taken under his wing, and that's our mark. The beautiful part of that is, and it'll come back earliest tonight, is that in reading Mark's Gospel, we're listening to Peter. I think Peter is the author, the inspirer, the memory of it all. Mark is the scribe. But we're listening to a lot of Peter as we listen to Mark's Gospel. Eusebius wrote the earliest history of the church about the year 300. He wrote it before the emperor became a Christian, in Constantine, thank you. He wrote before the change there, and when Constantine became a Christian, he rewrote a lot of the stuff in his history. So it comes from before, but rewritten in the light of the changed circumstances. Well, he writes this in his history of the church. So greatly did the splendour of piety illumine the minds of Peter's hearers that they were not satisfied with hearing once only, and were not content with the unwritten teaching of the divine gospel. Oral tradition, people telling their stories. It's beautiful, but hang on, the apostles are getting old now, and the memory may die. But all sorts of entreaties, they besought Mark, a follower of Peter, and the one whose gospel is extant, that he would leave them a written monument of the doctrine which had been orally communicated to them. Nor did they cease until they prevailed upon the man and had thus become the occasion of the written gospel which bears the name of Mark. So there's some persuasion going on to this quite skilled writer. The text continues, and they say that Peter, when he learned through a revelation of the Spirit of that which had been done, was pleased with the zeal of the men, and that the work obtained the sanction of his authority for the purpose of being used in the churches. So that's Eusebius, 230-40 years later, writing. I've actually come at it from a slightly different angle because of other reading I've done. I'm kind of prefer to think that Peter didn't just find out and give his blessing. No doubt he did that, but he also inspired it. Clement, that's Clement the Pope at the end of the first century, in his eighth book of his Hupotuposes, gives this account, says Eusebius, and with him agrees the bishop of Hierapolis named Papias. So he's a historian, he's done his homework, he's found out this stuff from Clement and from Papias and other people, no doubt, and he's written it in his history. This is the statement we know from Papias early in the second century. It's quoted by Eusebius elsewhere, and this is what it says. It says, when Mark became Peter's interpreter, he wrote down accurately, though not in order. It's not a chronology of Jesus' life or ministry. Of course, it begins with the baptism where all the Gospels begin and ends with the crucifixion. So they're fixed. But the rest of it is thematic, and he remembered what the Lord had said and done. That little diagram is meant to help me take you through what's going on. You start there. That's the beloved disciple, of course. But that's Jesus and a beloved disciple, any beloved disciple. In this retreat, you, each of you. From that experience that people had of Jesus, the apostles and Mary, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Simon of Cyrene at the end, from this experience of Jesus, they sought, as we do, understanding. We like to understand, we like to get a perspective on things. Faith is a decision we make to follow, but it's not a stupid decision. It's based on evidence and example and insight and prayer, of course. So faith is seeking understanding of what's going on here in this discipleship. Then it finds expression in these things in the early church: prayer, cult, meaning the Eucharist and so on, lifestyle of the Christians, how these Christians love one another, teaching, all that is going on straight after the death of Jesus and all the way through those early 35 or 30 years. If you can imagine that as Peter now, Peter's experiences there, and Mark, Peter's disciple, and all of these finally find their way into this amazing piece of literature, prayer literature, called the Gospel of Mark. So it picks up all of that. It's not, as I said, a biography, and it's not simply setting out to tell you what they saw with their eyes and heard with their ears. It's much richer than that, has to be. This is a love document. This is a document that's come out of all those religious experience, meditation, their own personal encounter with the risen Christ. So that's what they're sharing with us. Another element now. Mark's gospel is very conscious of conflict. You'll see that as you go through. A theme that's regular. Having lost his two mentors, Paul and Peter, in the persecution of Nero in the middle 60s, Mark completed his gospel during the catastrophe of the Jewish-Roman War, which broke out in 66 AD. It seems to be written before the conclusion of that war, but that war is going on with his relatives, no doubt, back in Palestine. So there's the murder of the apostles, there's the breakdown of order in Palestine, all going on. Many Christians must have been wondering about the reality of the salvation brought by Jesus. Mark realized that Christians must expect to suffer as Jesus suffered, and that they shouldn't let apparent failure in this life distract them from living as Jesus lived. God was faithful to Jesus and would be faithful to them. Their hope in Jesus would not be in vain, for Jesus was the promised Messiah. Another key theme in Mark. The one that their grandparents told them about when they were kids, the one their whole culture was reaching for. They're saying Jesus is the promised one. He is the Messiah. Now, of course, he died and rose. We're dying too. We're in this troubled world that doesn't seem to be finding much meaning in it, but hold on to your faith, is what Mark's telling them. Persevere, and it will be yours. C.S. Mann, in his commentary on Mark's gospel, writes, Mark's task was to present messiahship in the terms drastically reinterpreted by Jesus. Jesus didn't accept the term Messiah, because had he done it, everyone would have misunderstood what he was doing. Everyone had a fixed idea of the Messiah, and none of them were right. So he chose to call himself the Son of Man, a very vague title that has beautiful meaning in it, but everyone would have wondered what he meant. Had he said he was the Christ, then they would have misunderstood his mission. I now want to read to you from Assyrian. It's always very poignant today to remember the ancient Syrian church, Damascus, of course, Antioch in Syria. This was a whole Christian world till the Arab invasions and Islam and so on. And this ancient Christian people are still being, well, now being torn apart because they belong to nobody in that world. Well, St. Ephrem, who's a poet, a liturgist, a musician, has this to say. It'll take a couple of pages, but it's quite beautiful advice for us, I think. Lord, he says, who can grasp all the wealth of just one of your words? What we understand is much less than what we leave behind. Like thirsty people who drink from a fountain. For your word, Lord, has many shades of meaning. Just as those who study it have many different points of view. Pause. I'll obviously be doing my best to share with you the points of view I've come to through study, of course, but that's all it is. There's a lot more to Mark's gospel than I'll ever grasp or you'll ever grasp. But that's why it's important for us to listen to our response and to look at the study and all that, of course. So, back to Ephrem. The Lord has coloured his words with many hues so that each person who studies it can see in it what he or she loves. The Lord has hidden many treasures in his word so that each of us is enriched as we meditate on it. Coming into contact with some share of its treasure, you shouldn't think that the only thing contained in the word is what you yourself have found. Because you couldn't exhaust it, you should give thanks for its riches. Be glad that you are overcome, and don't be sad that it proved too much for you. And he continues, rather let the fountain, and here we're talking about Mark's gospel, of course, let the fountain quench your thirst. Prefer that than have your thirst quench the fountain. Because if your thirst is quenched and the fountain is not exhausted, you can drink from it again whenever you're thirsty. But if when your thirst is quenched, the fountain also is dried up. Brackets. Oh, I've been through Mark. I understand Mark's gospel. What are you going to do next? No. Your victory will bode evil for you. Be grateful for what you've received and don't grumble about the abundance left behind. When you've received what you've received and what you've reached is your share, what remains is your heritage, still to come. What at one time you were unable to receive because of your weakness, you will be able to receive at other times if you persevere. Don't have the presumption to try to take in one draught what cannot be taken in one draught, and do not abandon out of laziness what you may consume only little by little. I'm nearly concluded, but I am going to do chapter 1, verse 1 with you now, for reasons that have become obvious. Mark begins his gospel The beginning of the good news, that's what gospel means, of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. That's his wonderful introduction to tell you where he's going to take you. The beginning, anyone familiar with the sacred texts of the Old Testament, here, in the beginning, the first words of the Hebrew book of Genesis. So this is the beginning. And you've got that whole creation, light, water, life, let there be, all of that is in the feeling of that word. It's about Jesus the Messiah. That's actually the first chunk, first half of the gospel is about that. And it concludes in chapter 8, verse 29, with Peter saying, "You are the Messiah." An extraordinary statement of love, of prayer insight. Because Jesus didn't look anything like any of the pictures of the Messiah that were around. He wasn't a victorious king. He wasn't going to clear the land, etc. He wasn't a high priest. He was Jesus. And here, halfway through the gospel, Peter, who lived with him, laughed with him, cried with him, walked with him, was able to say, when Jesus says, "Who do you say I am?" It'd be lovely if we could say this. "You're the Christ. You're the promised one. You're the one I was told about from my youth. You are. You're the one I know. You're the Messiah." Extraordinary. That's the first part of the gospel. The second part of the gospel ends with the centurion standing in front and watching Jesus die on the cross. And he says, "In truth, this man was God's son." We'll have to depth the meaning of that and don't bring too much into it from later church teaching. Let's keep with Mark as close as we can. But whatever Mark is going to tell us, he's the Messiah, and you won't understand him, his teaching, his miracles, his presence, unless you see in him a life that comes entirely from God. So it reveals God. Jesus reveals God, incarnates God.